26, and now we have session 2 of talking with Hanbury Brown on 30th August 76 also. Well, I thought this time we could just go more specifically through the various scientific projects you worked on that we didn't mention before. We certainly talked about M31 and the Cygnus A getting positioned in fluxes. Did we talk about clusters of galaxies?
Oh, yes.
And large-scale radio features corresponding to the distribution of galaxies.
Yes, I'm very sorry we never were able to push that on. Really, the sense in which that work still needs doing, it could almost be taken over at the point now where we left it off there. The idea there was, of course, that if a radio extragalactic radio emission came from a distribution of extragalactic radiators, galaxies with some sort of luminosity function, then if we scanned the irregularities in the optical distribution of galaxies, like the Virgo cluster, we might expect to see radio contours associated with it.
Right.
And that was the object behind that work. And so we started off by doing this, and we thought we had detected some faint correlations. However, we had to give it up because it transpired that the sky was not as simple as that, but that certain major features in the sky were not attributable to extragalactic radiation anyhow, of which the North Polar Spur was the biggest. And I said that before any more work is done, we must sort out what belongs to the galaxy and what doesn't.
Right.
And so we switched our attention to working on the North Polar Spur. That's really the story of that.
You say now that it would be nice to follow that up now, but how can one still distinguish?
Well, I don't know.
I think that's probably
one
no one
has. I'm not too sure, but it's always struck me that one ought to be able to associate irregularities in the radio contours with irregularities in the extragalactic distribution. And one of the things I notice about work that goes on nowadays, of course, is that the use of high frequencies, very high frequencies, makes so many of these things so much more difficult. For example, papers have been written about whether or not galaxies have halos and so on. And in point of fact, most of these papers have been based on observations at such a high frequency that you wouldn't see the halo anyhow, because the surface temperature varies as the 2.7 power of the wavelength.
Yeah.
And the chance of seeing a halo of a galaxy at centimeter waves based on what we did on Andromeda and so on is zero.
What you're saying is that low frequency radio astronomy is really being neglected now.
I'm saying that a great deal more there are things that you can learn in the meter wave region which you can't learn in the centimeter wave region, and fashion has turned us all to the centimeter wave region at the moment.
Now, so does it transpire then that the Cygnus loop, North Polar Spur sort of corresponds with the supergalactic plane? I didn't realize that.
We're
close to it? And that's what led you
to
say this?
Yes, that's right. They interfere with each other, yes. There's a region in which the North Polar Spur would be indistinguishable from the supergalactic equator. Yeah, that's right. And I was frightened that, we might misidentify one with the other.
Yeah. Now, in 52 in Nature, you and Hazard published a paper on Tycho's supernova remnant and said that you found a radio source.
That's right, yes.
But there's no optical object. It was known then anyway. I'm not sure if there is now. I guess now there is some very faint stuff that's been seen.
I think they've seen some faint wispy stuff,
right,
but I can't remember.
What did you make of this?
It was due to the fact that Kopal gave a lecture and pointed out that if John Bolton's work in the Southern Hemisphere on the identification of the the Crab Nebula with a radio source was valid, then one might expect other supernova remnants to be radio sources. And for this reason, we looked at all the ones we could, and they were the only ones that were in the field of view of the 218-foot radio telescope.
And so you actually looked at a position that where Tycho had seen a supernova remnant, and no one else has ever seen anything since, really.
Yes, that's right, we looked at the position, allowing for precession,
You had learned enough astronomy by that time.
Yes, I've always known about that.
We talked about the the first intensity interferometer position measurements of Cygnus A, you had, in the first paper in Nature with Jennison and Dasgupta, you had four different baselines at different angles, and you showed that Cygnus A was asymmetrical. That was what you got out of that.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
And I'm just wondering, this seems to me to be one of the first times that people have done different angles on an object in order to... Was this principle pretty obvious?
It probably was the first time.
Why wasn't more of this done before?
Oh, well, there hadn't been any really much interferometry before then anyhow, had there? I mean, this was...
Well, that's true. This is 52.
I suppose something had been done on the sun, had it? I'm not too sure.
Well, not two-dimensional. I mean,
no.
East-west and moving the baseline out, Stenier
yeah,
did
yeah,
that thing.
Yeah. Well, I regarded it as obvious, really. But,
Now, in 53, you summarized a symposium on radio astronomy held at Jodrell Bank,
yes,
an observatory.
Right.
And the 55 meeting, I've talked to many people about, but I haven't heard very much about this 53 meeting. Could you tell me what the purpose was of it and what your impressions were?
I wrote an article in the Observatory on it, I think.
Right, yes, you did, yeah.
No, I would if I could, but I'm afraid I can't. I've almost forgotten it. Actually, I can recall practically nothing about it at all, except that there was very little radio astronomy in America,
Was it designed to be an international meeting?
Yes, I think so. I think it was. No, I'm sorry, I can't help you. I really have forgotten it completely.
Well, of course, I can look there, but I was just
No, I've forgotten it. Those were the sort of days when we were trying to sort out questions like, is there a population of radio stars in the galaxy? Is there a population outside the galaxy? All that sort of thing, you know?
Yeah.
Still in those days.
Now, what about the 55 Jodrell Bank Symposium? What stands out in your mind is...
Well, that
came
was
out
a
of that
good
meeting.
One, yes. Again, I hate to say it, but I can't remember that.
Fair enough answer.
Yeah.
You don't want you to make things up.
No, I wouldn't be making it up.
Yeah. Okay. Well, moving on to the 58 Paris Symposium.
Oh, yes. That was very interesting. I remember that better. Yes. That was an interesting thing. I suppose that was in the days when the famous log-in, log-s controversy was really going. And this lent a sort of certain extra excitement to the meeting, I think, because there were disagreements between the Cambridge people and the Australians. And that was rather fun, actually. I remember Joe Pawsey trying to, opposing the Cambridge views, yes. That was an interesting meeting because of that controversy.
Now, I've heard several other people say that, but what about the other areas, the solar work, the hydrogen line work? Was that just all sort of...
No, it was all interesting. It was just sort of when all these things were fairly new and active. It was a most interesting, lively meeting. And all of us were young then, too. made a difference.
You mean you fought stronger for your ideas?
Yes, I think we did fought more strongly for them. Yes, I think so, yes. Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, we were told by the Cambridge people how things were, and then, our job was to get up and try and show that was wrong. We had a lot of fun doing it, too.
So now you're speaking as a Jodrell Bank
person, of course.
Sorry, Cambridge against both the other
major
groups.
That's right. Yes, well, we used to side with the Australians, usually, against Cambridge, yes.
Right. Now, in 53, in PhilMag, you had a whole model of the galactic background.
Yes.
Taking all the... Can you tell me what the status was?
Yes, well, that was an effort to try to explain the major features of the galaxy in radio emission. And to try and explain it by a distribution of radiators, in other words, in the galaxy. To find out whether or not the distribution of radiators corresponded with any particular distribution of mass, for example, with the distribution of globular clusters, or the distribution of population 1 or population 2.
Right.
It was an effort to produce a three-dimensional model of the distribution of radiators in an effort to help establish the origin of the galactic radio emission. You see, nobody at that time had any clear ideas about the origin of the actual emission.
No. When did you first become aware of the whole synchrotron idea and so forth, yourself?
I think the first paper was in Alphane, someone from memory.
That's right. Alphane, well, Kiepenhauer.
Herlufsen, Alphane?
Well, Alphane and Herlufsen had one on Radio Stars.
Yes.
And Kiepenhauer had one on the Galactic Background, both in 1950.
Yes.
And then the Russians picked it up.
Skolovsky. Skolovsky is the one who really drove it home.
And Ginsberg was also.
Yes. Skolovsky.
But why were you not using that then in your model in 1953? It seems to me that you were talking about in terms of localized sources and a disk of H2.
Yes.
And this sort of thing.
Yes, we were trying to find out what. We assumed that the mechanism of radiation from the sources. You know, the non-thermal radiation might be explained by synchrotron radiation, perhaps, but I don't know whether we mentioned it or not now, I couldn't say, but there were these two things, non-thermal and thermal radiation. And so we assumed that the radio stars were non-thermal radiation and the other distribution was thermal, and we tried to find a thing which would fit all the observations at all the frequencies which had then been used.
Right, yeah.
And that model, in fact, was fairly useful and a reasonable model. And in fact, you'll find that Professor Oort, in his article in the Springer, Handbook de Physique, in fact, uses it quite extensively.
And
I think, is a reasonable compliment from him.
Right. But what I'm still trying to get at is why, at that time, did you feel like the non-thermal background must be the integral of many localized sources as opposed to an interstellar sort of phenomenon?
I always tried to explain everything in terms of the minimum number of assumptions, and we did know that radio sources existed, and I always wanted to try and explain it in terms of supernovae remnants, as a matter of fact. As you'll see, there's a thing of mine in the observatory somewhere there which tries to explain the radio stars in the galaxy entirely in terms of supernova remnants and comes up with a rate for supernova formation, which is was thought to be too high in those days, but is now regarded as quite introspective.
What was it?
I forgot. Once every 50 years. Something like once every 50 years. Or something like that.
Right, that was 54. Speculation that all meter wavelength radio sources in the galaxy could be supernova remnants.
Yes, that's right. Yes, I suggested they should all have been supernova remnants in those days. But that wasn't taken very seriously at the time because it involved too high a rate, people thought, of supernova formation.
Based on what? Zwicky's?
Based on the fact that supernova only occurred on the average once every 200 years or something in galaxies,
Now, what about the survey that came to be called the HB sources in 53?
That was the straight out bread and butter work with a 218 foot dish. It was extremely hard work indeed because it took the most of the morning, really hard work by two people, to move the antenna through half a beam width to take the next scan because the instrument, as I said, had 18 guy ropes, steel guy ropes, and you had to let them off in the right order, otherwise the steel mast would kink, and you had to watch it with two theodolites at right angles. So
I see.
It wasn't at all an easy job.
You had these theodolites set up on the outside.
We had theodolites at right angles, yes, to get the thing straight in right ascension and declination, yes.
And these two people, I suppose, were Hanbury Brown and Hussein.
Yes, we literally worked our fingers to the bone to do that survey. Apart from the fact that it was quite difficult to get the stability required in the receiver in those days.
Yeah, and so you got the whole sky that could be seen.
Yes, everything that could be seen with that instrument. And we reckon that was about all you could do with that instrument.
But now, it's also interesting, in the interpretation, you had 23 sources, and in the interpretation you have something that's rather similar to Mills's survey, which came out just about that same time, 53.
Yes.
Namely, an isotropic component of weaker radio sources and the more intense ones and the larger ones near the galactic plane.
Yes, well, this was very obvious. When you laid these beautiful traces out in the long line through the galaxy, you could see these sources, these big sources, in the plane. And so we noticed that there was a concentration of the more powerful sources into the galactic plane. And I well remember a visit by the Cambridge team once to Jodrell Bank in the early days where we pointed this out. And one of the sources we were timing from was the one that right ascension is 5 hours. 5 hour source, we called it. And I remember them saying, looking at these things and saying, well, this phenomenon simply didn't exist. these sources were must be side lobes or something. And that was one of the controversies we had with Cambridge, as a matter of fact, because we knew they existed, and we had in fact used an auxiliary interferometer to show they weren't side lobes of more powerful sources. And the reason why the Cambridge people didn't notice this was in fact they were doing their observations with an interferometer with a resolution that was so high that they resolved these sources in the plane and didn't see them.
Right, but why did they insist they didn't exist? I mean, they must
because they couldn't see them, you see. They didn't but they didn't realize that they were all large angular diameter. This is what we showed at Jodrell Bank. I mean, that was the difference between using a beam and using an interferometer.
Right.
One of the interesting differences in the two techniques that came out.
Right, which of course was involved with the controversy with Mills also.
Yes, that's right. And Mills, of course, was also... Well, yes, all right. But it's a good illustration of the fact that you do want to use a variety of instruments. In other words, complementary observations are valuable.
But now...
They had, in fact, missed one of the main features of the sky.
In the abstract of this article, it says that that you expect that the isotropic sources are probably extragalactic.
Yes, yes.
And I suppose this was influenced by the Cygnus A identification.
Yes, it was, yes. We were in correspondence with Ms. Minkowski at the time, and Spitzer, and they had identified the Cygnus source, and they thought they knew what it was. They thought it was the collision between two galaxies. Yes.
Right. But now, do you mean Bada when you...
I mean Bada, yes. Bada. Minkowski and Bada, that's right.
But then, a couple years later, when you did that model, the model at the same time.
Yes.
Oh, I see. You have an isotropic extragalactic component, you have a disk component,
yes.
And then you have a population 2 component,
that's
which
right.
is spherical but offset. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now,
I may say that one of the great things in that time radio astronomy that we were also trying to bring out clearly, a very important one, was the influence of the instrument on what you observed. In other words, not only the fact that high resolution resolved out the angular diameter sources, large angular diameter sources in the plane, and so obscured this feature, but also the fact that the effect of beam width, I mean, quite simply, the effect of beam width on the apparent angular size of sources. That's
right,
another thing we
right.
were pushing. And on the apparent angular size of the distribution of the galactic plane. All of this was brought out subsequently very well by Bracewell.
Yeah.
A very influential paper by Bracewell.
Now, you're speaking of not the one on restoration, or...?
Yes, it's an early paper on the effect of resolution you see. Yeah, very influential paper.
Now, in 53, you detected M81.
Yes.
And you also have a comment in this Nature article about how the radio magnitude, which you defined, goes proportional to the photographic magnitude. Now, this is a personal bias, but magnitude seems to be the most archaic thing, and I would think that you, who usually does things in a very nice method, would have been the first to try to undo that and rather change all the magnitudes into fluxes. Why did you bring in this radio magnitude thing?
Well, what we were interested in, whether or not there was a relationship between the light and the radio emission from radio galaxies, from galaxies in general. And of course, we thought that as we were trying to do astronomy, we'd better use the magnitude scale for the astronomical facts as well as for the light, because that would make more acceptable to the astronomical community. So we tried to define the radio magnitude scale so that radio magnitude 0 corresponded to optical magnitude 0. But of course, this just didn't work out.
Right.
And so we ended up with this awful formula about 53.4 log something or other, log something or other minus 53.4. I do regret that magnitude scale, because it pursued me for years, actually.
But it was an attempt at communication. Do you think it helped at all?
It was an attempt at making radio results more acceptable to optical astronomy.
Instead of watts per meter squared per hertz,
yes,
just throwing them off. Do you think it helped? Did it bridge the gap at all?
Oh, I believe it did, yes. I believe it's done its little bit towards... we were really aiming for a radio index, you see.
Yeah, right.
Equivalent to
a color. A radio color.
Or an infrared index or something, yes.
Right. Let's see. We talked about the rotating lobe interferometer. You and Lovell wrote an article in Vistas in Astronomy on large radio telescopes.
Oh, yes, that was just a duty article. Yes.
Cygnus loop. We haven't talked about the Cygnus loop.
Ah, yes.
Which you measured at 92 megahertz.
Yes, we did. That was the first detection of the Cygnus loop. It was absolutely at the limit of the 220-foot dish. And in order to make certain that our observations were not spurious, we had, in fact, to build an auxiliary interferometer to show that the observations we were making of the Cygnus loop were not side lobes of Cassiopeia or Cygnus or anything else.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, we did a rather careful job on that, but it was using the 220-foot dish at too wide an angle from the zenith. It was in a situation where the main lobe had developed quite serious coma.
I see.
That was the only way we could do it.
Was the low frequency just to get a little bit more signal? Is that why you were down at 92? I think most of your other stuff was that you had a big object and you didn't need to...
Yes, I can't remember the answer to that. I don't know now. I don't know why. Was it done at 92 megahertz?
Yes.
Oh, I don't remember that.
Okay, moving on. Hanbury, Brown, Palmer, and Thompson, 55, in monthly notices, you look for polarization in Cygnus, Cass, and Taurus.
Yes.
Had anyone looked for polarization in these sources before, or what was the motivation?
I don't think they looked for it in these radio sources. I don't know but I don't think so.
I don't think so either.
And we thought we'd better look for polarization. And
what was the motivation? Was it simply just on general principles?
Yes, I can't really remember that, I'm afraid. I think it was just synchrotron radiation theory that we thought we'd better look for polarization. I think so.
Well, okay, so it was based on what it...
Yes.
Maybe that mentions in the article, of course.
Yes, we used the shot tower, so-called shot tower, the antenna that was mounted on a gun barrel on the shot tower in the Festival of Britain. We inherited that antenna afterwards, and it was circularly symmetrical. You could turn it round. And that's why it was particularly useful for polarization.
I see. And what do you mean by a shot tower?
Oh, that's on the bank of the Thames.
It's a specific...
It's where they used to make shot, you know. This antenna was mounted on the top of the shot tower at the Festival of Britain as a sort of modern decoration or so.
I see. Let's see. We've talked about the Jago Bank meeting and... Now I see, moving into 1960, you have an article with Hazard in which you definitely say the disk component of synchrotron emission from spiral arms. You'd become convinced by then. What was it that really...
Everything. I suppose there'd been a lot of work by other people, I think. I can't remember exactly what. No, I couldn't tell you.
The polarization that Westerhout had found.
I think that, Mills had found some evidence of signs in the distribution of the galactic plane of the presence of spiral arms.
Right, he had steps as he
yes,
went.
Yes, and so I did some work on the magnetic field in these spiral arms or something. I can't remember that paper very well now, actually.
I don't have any more about it.
Anyhow, it's to do with
the
direction of the magnetic field in the spiral arms, and whether or not it's lined up exactly with the spiral arms, and I think we calculated the root mean square deviation of the magnetic field direction.
I see. Okay, the last one I see here we haven't talked about is with Hazard in 59 in monthly notices, you have with the new Mark I observations of M33 and M31, and you find a disk, and according to the abstract, and a corona, but much weaker than our own galaxy.
Yes. Yes, I think that's true. We used the... one of the first things we did with the Mark I after we got it working was to survey these things, and we made a map which we thought delineated the corona of M31 quite nicely, but... I don't know what the modern view would be about that now, actually.
Well, it's still controversial.
I think it's controversial still.
It is. I mean, it's been done at Bonn recently. And,
yes.
It's still controversial.
As I say, the thing to remember is that we were working at a rather longer wave, and people aren't doing that nowadays, because you need a very large antenna, and you have very bad resolution.
Right.
And the argument always is that you integrate over radio stars which are in the region and tend to blur them out into what looks like a corona. And, all I can say is that I suppose one really ought to add up all the radio stars which are now known from higher resolution surveys and take them away and see what you get.
Yeah.
But I've never done that.
Yeah. What did you think would be the really useful things that the Mark I could contribute to radio astronomy? You've already mentioned that, you know, it wasn't exactly your style, but at that time...
Oh, definitely the surveying of galaxies. I've always been interested in doing that with it. That was what I really wanted to do with it, to survey galaxies.
In the continuum.
Yes, mm. Yes indeed. Oh, and of course hydrogen 9, obviously. But the thing I wanted to do with it was to do galaxy surveys. Mm-hmm.
Well, that covers all the specific points I had here. And we, like I say, we went through a lot of philosophy last time. Any other comments that you'd like to make in closing? So you can look over there.
I'm sure there would be something when one wanted to say when one, you know, after one had thought about it for a moment, but just at the moment I can't think of anything right off the cuff. No.
Okay, thank you very much. That ends the interview with Hanbury Brown on 30th August 76. And now we're